from Texas Public Radio. This is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, a controversial EPA order on water contamination in North Texas is proven correct. And it's time to single out the biggest goofballs of the year with the Bum Steer Awards. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In 2010, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency ordered that drinking water needed to be provided to several Parker County families after their water wells were contaminated by nearby natural gas drilling. One resident said the water became cloudy, bubbly, and could actually catch fire. The case became a flashpoint between residents who feared that local natural gas fracking operations were causing health and environmental damage and the natural gas industry. When the EPA stepped in, Texas political figures accused the agency of government overreach. In 2011, there was a settlement in the case in which the water order was lifted. Texas Senator John Cornyn and five other senators then called for an investigation into the case. Cornyn was quoted saying the EPA has systematically targeted Texas through burdensome regulatory overreach, putting politics ahead of facts and due process. But this week, a report by the agency's Office of Inspector General found no wrongdoing on the part of the EPA, but said there were still questions about that water contamination. At the center of the case was the EPA's Region 6 head, Al Armendariz, who had oversight of Texas. Armendariz came under fire and was forced to resign after a video surfaced showing him liking his approach at the EPA to Roman conquerors who used crucifixion to deter dissent. I spoke to Armendariz about the new report, which essentially clears his name.
The internal EPA watchdog, which is called the Office of the Inspector General, released a report earlier this week based on a congressional request. And the report focused on an EPA investigation and enforcement action of some potentially contaminated water in Parker County, Texas. And the conclusion of the watchdog, the Inspector General's office, was that EPA followed the law and all applicable rules and regulations when it conducted its investigation and took its action.
So let's talk about this water, this contaminated water in Parker County. What was wrong with the water?
There was a homeowner in Parker County, Texas, who noticed a lot of bubbling of effervescence like champagne in his drinking water and called state and then eventually federal agencies to help him out. He was looking for some assistance, and so EPA enforcement and water investigators began to look into his problems and eventually concluded that the contamination of his water was caused by oil and gas activity.
The Texas Railroad Commission also conducted an investigation. Did they find have the same findings?
You know, I can't speak for the Railroad Commission, but I do know that the EPA staff were well coordinating with their counterparts at the Railroad Commission.
Well, according to this AP story that I'm looking at, it says that the Railroad Commission's, they disputed the EPA's findings.
You know, I can't speak for the Railroad Commission, but I do know that EPA is required to notify state oil and gas regulators, and according to the Inspector General's report, it did so properly. And the EPA took action only when the state didn't.
Well, according to the Railroad Commission, they said that that aquifer, that water source, had been naturally contaminated with the methane, which caused that bubbling, and that a driller was not to blame, the range resources. So, I mean, this is in a Barnett Shale area?
Yeah, that's right. Parker County, Texas, is not far from the city of Fort Worth.
But it was still rural enough that there were plenty of people still dependent on well water for their personal use.
That's right. Yeah, there are still a certain percentage of people in Texas who live outside of the major cities in suburban areas or in some of our rural counties who are very dependent on groundwater. And you know, it's important that we protect those groundwater sources because it really is what many small towns and small communities depend on for drinking and other uses in their homes.
So when this homeowner found that his groundwater, his well, was producing water that was bubbling, and then y'all did look into it, what did y'all find?
Yeah, so the homeowner, you know, filed a complaint with EPA, and EPA went out and conducted a series of tests, and the tests showed a high degree of match between natural gas that was being commercially produced by wells in the area and the natural gas that this homeowner was finding in his well. EPA investigators used a technique called isotopic fingerprinting, which is designed to give you essentially a kind of a DNA match between one particular kind of hydrocarbon and another. And they found a high degree of match between natural gas that was being commercially produced in the area and the natural gas that was in this homeowner's drinking water well.
Were they using hydrofracking to get to the natural gas?
You know, hydraulic fracturing is used in a large fraction of oil and gas wells that are put into production today in the United States. And I believe the vast majority of wells in the Barnett Shale area do use hydraulic fracturing as part of the production process.
So when they found the this well was contaminated and they found it was with methane and benzene we know to be a cancer-causing agent.
Yeah, benzene is one of the most dangerous hydrocarbons. It's usually only present in low levels in oil and gas, but unfortunately it can be harmful even at low levels. And so when benzene is found in someone's water or you find benzene emissions in the air, it's important to try to stop those emissions or stop those releases and minimize exposure to people to that benzene, especially to children.
So what did the EPA do at that point when you found that drinking water had been contaminated with this highly toxic cancer-causing substance?
You know, the Inspector General's report has a good timeline of the actions that EPA took, and it describes how once EPA identified the likely contamination of the drinking water with methane and benzene from oil and gas productions, that EPA followed the procedures in the Safe Drinking Water Act and took steps to order a nearby gas drilling operation to identify the source of the leak and stop it.
Now, what about the water that the people had to drink? Where were they going to get their water from?
Yeah, I've not spoken to the homeowners that that live in the area around that well, but it's my understanding that one of the homeowners there is trucking in water from a nearby water company, and according to reports, he appears to pay hundreds of dollars a month to have this water trucked in. And other folks in the area who don't have those resources are continuing to use the water from their own drinking water well.
If you have a well and it's a perfectly good well, and you're getting your water from it, and then you find out that it's now contaminated, and then a government agency, the EPA, says it's because these guys are doing their hydrofracking natural gas extraction nearby, is there any liability there?
I'm not sure I can. You know, it's difficult to generalize. I suspect if you examine your drinking water wells that have been contaminated or that have presence of methane or benzene, you'll probably find a variety of potential sources. And so it's important to do good science and important to try to identify whether that contamination is naturally occurring from microbes or other things in the soil, or is it from industrial activity or oil and gas drilling? And it's important to try to get the science right. And the good thing about the Inspector General's report is they appear to uphold exactly what EPA did and indicated that EPA followed the proper procedures in conducting its science and in following the law as it prosecuted the case.
Now, the Texas Railroad Commission did their own investigation. They found no evidence that the driller had contaminated the water, and the Railroad Commission voted in March of 2011 to clear the company of any of these charges. And even the then commissioner, Elizabeth Ames Jones, said that we'll see who the real protection agency is, I guess alluding to the EPA. And she said, I say it's the Railroad Commission of Texas. So, I mean, you individually became under attack quite viscerously by, you know, some people really called you out, especially Texas Senator John Cornyn, saying that you were being overzealous in this investigation.
You know, I was, although, frankly, it's part of the job of being a regional administrator is to, you know, lead a fantastic group of scientists and attorneys and geologists and support their work, and I was very happy to do so. You're right that I became somewhat of the target of accusations by Senator Cornyn and others who were doing their best to protect an industry that has bankrolled many politicians from Texas for a very long time. But my focus was on, you know, what did the science show and what did the law say? And making sure that everything we did conformed with the evidence that was in front of us and the best science that we had. And if that meant that we eventually were going to take action that made a particular company angry or politicians angry, it was my job to support staff and to deflect that criticism and to show people that what we were doing was in the best interest of Texans. You know, the EPA staff that I worked with were fantastic. Groups of people who wake up every day with the sole mission of protecting the public health of people in Texas and in neighboring states. And in this particular case, I'm proud of the work that we did. I think we got the science right. I think we got the law right. And the Inspector General's report completely validated all the work that we did.
Al Armendariz is the former EPA Regional Administrator for Texas. He is now the Senior Campaign Representative for the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. The energy boom in the Permian Basin in West Texas is driving one of the nation's fastest-growing regional economies, but growth is tied to the price of oil, and some prominent energy analysts suggest that the price of crude will fall in 2014. Lauren Madelon of Marfa Public Radio looks at what that price drop might mean.
This is the nonstop sound of a region transformed. Modern technologies like fracking and horizontal drilling are cutting the cost of extracting oil and gas from what was once the floor of an ancient seabed laced with hydrocarbons.
My name is Bob Randolph. We're in Jackson 1H for Arbella Petroleum.
Randolph's an oil field supervisor. He runs crews drilling through the Permian's porous shale. 140-foot tall rigs back up against each other onto the dusty horizon.
Things are real good, you know. The drilling industry is doing good. The price of oil is hanging in. Need the price of natural gas to come up a little bit, but the oil field is doing real good right now.
In Texas, they say everything's bigger. Never more true than in the Permian Basin today. Private jets compete for parking space. Rents are on a par with San Francisco. Streets are full of luxury cars, all pegged to oil and gas prices. The price of West Texas Intermediate Crude, WTI, is the nation's benchmark for oil. Right now, it's around $98 a barrel, a healthy price for continued industry growth. But one of the industry's most followed analysts says the price of crude is set for a drop. Fadil Gate at Oppenheimer in New York just sent a note to clients predicting prices will fall hard in 2014. We reached Gate on his cell phone.
We think oil prices are inflated by as much as 20 to 30%.
Gates says that in the big picture, the Permian's economy should withstand any downward pressure. The big players like ExxonMobil and Chevron are established here. But Gates suggests that some jobs may be lost and that there are a host of smaller operators that could be threatened.
I think we are in a bubble, and bubbles always burst. The question is not if, it's when.
We met up with longtime oil man Bill Dingus of Midland, Texas, at a restaurant bustling with people from the oil field. He says that even if prices drop, modern technology will continue to cut the cost of extraction. That means the energy play here will be sustained.
The difference between today and 20 years ago is Used to, you drill a hole in the ground and you hope you find oil. Now we know we'll find oil.
Dingus says industry consolidation that Gate refers to has already started.
And the reason is because this is a big boy game. It's expensive drilling, and if the price does drop, the margins get smaller, and it squeezes out the people who can't live on a 12% rate of return.
12% is considered a modest return these days in the Permian Basin. Benjamin Shattuck with Wood Mackenzie in Houston says crude won't plummet. He concedes it may fall a little bit, but says Permian Basin companies with deep pockets will thrive.
And everything we've seen is that these are pretty promising plays going forward. Certainly a lot of work to be done, and there is uncertainty there. But for the best operators, you're looking at a very bright picture going forward.
Back in the oil field, Bob Randolph is scurrying around the base of a rig. His employer, Arabella Petroleum, is cash rich enough to survive any price drop. He says they're ready if it does.
So even if it drops some, we would be okay.
Some workers in the oil fields of Texas and New Mexico are concerned that lower priced crude may threaten their jobs. But many investors hope the oil market cools. They're looking for a buying opportunity to get into the Permian Basin boom. I'm Lorne Matalon in Odessa, Texas.
The end of the year means it's time to look back at the biggest goofballs of Texas of 2013. Texas Monthly calls them bum steers. And Editor-in-Chief Jake Silverstein joins us for a look.
So every year we give out our bum steer awards. It's something we've been doing since the magazine was founded in the early 1970s. And really what they are is kind of dishonorable mentions, essentially. These are awards for people who are normal folks that you haven't heard of who've done silly things, or famous people who have done silly things, or institutions that have blundered in a big way. Basically, it's our chance to take a look back in a spirit of good humor at the previous year and try to pinpoint all of the really stupid things that happened in Texas.
Years past, we've had individuals on the bum steer award. Who's going to get the award? Last year was Lance Armstrong. Whatever happened to that guy? Before that, Dick Cheney, other folks. So
Rick Perry the year before with the unable to remember the third agency of government.
Yeah, the oops that was heard around the world. So who do we have this year?
So this year is a little different, and we do it a little bit differently each year because it just depends on what has happened that year. This year, the bum steer of the year actually was a three-way tie, one individual and two sports teams, the Houston Texans, the Houston Astros, and Lieutenant Governor David Duhurst, also from Houston. So we sort of made a joke out of it in the magazine that the steer-pocalypse was centered in Houston this past year.
Okay, so let's talk about the cover. There's been some buzz about that because of the way that the Astros are portrayed.
Oh, yeah, we also gave ourselves a bum steer post facto because our illustrator used the uniform that the Astros have worn did wear from 2000 to 2012 and not the one that they wore this past season. Which our joke on that was that did they even field the team this past season?
And these aren't even the real players.
Well, some of them are, and some of them are players that have played in past seasons. So, yeah, we gave ourselves a bum steer for that, for a goof on the illustration. The cover shows the Astrodome being destroyed. Another reason, another part of the focus on Houston was that the voters, of course, elected not to save and preserve the eighth wonder of the world this past year. And then you've also got David Duhurst on his telephone, and we can get into why he's got the telephone there. Ted Cruz reading from Green Eggs and Ham, which he did on the floor of the Senate. Matt Schaub trying to flee on crutches. And they're all trying to run away from a giant evil monster, a bum steer, Zilla.
And Jerry Jones in a helicopter nearby.
Jerry Jones trying to fire on the animal from the helicopter.
Now, but first, I want to get back to the uniform. So I understand that the artist was told to look at a baseball game to see what it looked like, but he could only find an old baseball game from...
Well, that was a joke that we were making on Twitter, because there was one of the other reasons that the Astros were so pathetic this year is that they had this terrible deal with Comcast, and so very few people could actually see their games. In fact, a couple of their games got 0.00 Nielsen ratings. So we were sort of making a joke about that in the aftermath. No, but it's just an honest goof. I mean, our illustrator literally couldn't find any clips from the correct season. He just made an error. It's a really stupid error because there's various people on staff here who are Astros fans, and we just missed it.
Let's go back to David Duhurst now on the phone. So what's up with the phone?
Well, so this was I think one of the funniest things that happened this year, although it's very painful for Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst. So he called the Allen PD, the police department up in Allen, Texas, near the Metroplex in I guess it was early August, trying to essentially spring a relative who had been arrested on a shoplifting charge from jail, where she was awaiting being transferred to the county sheriff. And the call was recorded, and the recording came out, and it just sort of gave Texans a very awkward glimpse of the lieutenant governor trying to sort of throw his weight around in a way that didn't quite work. So we had some fun with that. We've got him on the cover with his phone, and then we had some fun with the whole concept of Dewhurst making phone calls and trying to get special treatment. In our case, the joke we made was we have a transcript of him calling Domino's and trying to get special treatment on a pizza order from Domino's. So that was one of the goofiest stories of the year and most embarrassing ones, certainly for him. But then his co-bumsteers of the year, the Astros and the Texans, just have had unbelievably bad seasons. I mean, epically bad seasons. The Texans is still ongoing. When we went to press, they had lost 11 games in a row. That's now 13 games in a row. And they've just sort of keep setting a new bar for hopelessness. And of course, the Astros lost 111 games, putting them in the running for worst baseball team ever. So the fact that they're both in Houston, it was kind of funny.
Well, now the Astrodome, not the eighth wonder of the world any longer, we wonder what will replace it.
The Astrodome situation is more complicated, than it can seem, and there are good arguments on either side. Although it does seem like a shame to tear down something that has so many memories for people, and that we think of as the eighth wonder of the world. And there's a long piece by Mimi Swartz in that same Bumpsteer issue that gets into more of the nuance of this. But in the context of the Bumpsteer package, we just make fun of things. So in this case, we were suggesting some other attractions in the city of Houston that could be put forward as alternatives, so that Houston itself could keep the title of having the eighth wonder of the world. So there's the giant freak armadillo, the beer can house, the miracle Virgin Mary Oak, or Mount Rush Hour. Three or four landmarks that might take the place of the Astrodome.
The Bumpsteer Awards, it's a mix of everyday people who somehow find new ways to burn down their own houses.
Yeah, that is my favorite one, Dave. That is my favorite one that you just hit on.
That was the one they found a snake when they were mowing their lawn.
Yeah, it's a woman and her son. They're doing yard work and they see a snake, and they decide they're going to kill the snake by dousing it with gasoline and setting it on fire. Very awful thing to do. And, of course, the joke ends up being on them, because the snake slithers into the bushes, the bushes catch on fire, and then their home burns down. And, this is actually my favorite Bumpsteers every year are the ones that are like that are just average people, the sort of foibles of man kind of stuff. Not so much the stupid politicians or celebrities, but people like that or
that have to have an element of poetic justice.
That's right. That's right. Or just ones that are just flat out weird, like the doctor from Houston who had amputated the arm of a North Vietnamese soldier during the Vietnam War and kept it for all these years, kept the amputated arm. And then this past year, he went back to Vietnam to return the arm, which he'd kept in his home for 40 years, that kind of thing. These are just hilarious and weird and interesting stories that pop up all year long. And Bumpsteers is the time when we kind of scoop them all up.
Yeah, it's also a time to remember some of the oddities of our politicians. We probably read about them when they first popped up across the year, but then, we get caught up and in the time stream and we forget about things that, who could forget about Louis Gohmert, really?
No, in fact, we ended up not having space for it, but we were going to do a whole chart of what we were going to call Gohmints, which were moments of Louis Gohmert's just kind of transcendent silliness and goofiness and stupidity.
Jake Silverstein is the editor-in-chief of Texas Monthly. The 2013 Bumpsteer Award is shared by the Houston Astros, the Houston Texans, and Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst. The holidays aren't over yet, and for many in Texas, this is the season for feasting on tamales. Tamale making is as much a part of the culinary custom as the eating of them. But if you want to join in this tasty holiday tradition, you're going to need some coaching before you plunge your hands into the masa.
Don't use the vegetable steamers. They tend to be really shallow, and then you're going to get hunchback tamales. You don't want hunchback tamales.
You don't want hunched back tamales. Words of wisdom from a master tamale maker.
I'm Jesus de la Torre. I'm with Colectivo Cultural. My sisters Ada and Sabrina and my daughter Maya are here today to help people learn how to make tamales.
And this is a chile ancho. And this is actually a poblano pepper.
On this Saturday morning, Jesus has set up tables in a La Villita courtyard. It's one of the oldest parts of San Antonio, now filled with artisan shops. Jesus and his sisters are on a mission to teach people to make tamales, which is part recipe and part craft.
A lot of people have forgotten the tradition, and it's not because they want to forget it, it's because that they're missing a certain link. And so what we try to do is provide that link for them.
Margie Leos says somehow she lost that tamale link, but she's here this morning to reclaim it.
I want to be able to make them at my house with my family so I can know what I'm supposed to really be doing, because I was just a helper. And now I want to keep the tradition with my girls.
So you want to be the lead?
The leader. Mother. Yes, a tamalera. Yes, I do.
My name is Sabrina Lewis. I am sister to Jesus. We're teaching them to make tamales. That's our tradition at home for the holidays, for Christmas. And when our parents died, we thought, how is this tradition going to go on? We're going to do it. And that's what we do. Every year we get together and we come out here and we teach people how to make tamales. So if you don't like yuck, this is not for you. Pull your hands out
now.
Come
on, Phil, break it up.
You got to get in there like this. Squish it.
Massage it.
And
Ada Gordon. I'm the youngest, and us three started this tradition trying to teach people how to make tamales. Well, the masa we get from the molino, which is what's called non preparada. So we add the ingredients to it, the lard, the salt, the baking powder to it. And once you get it all kneaded, you know, ready to go, we have a trick, a test, which is the floating masa test. You grab a glass of water, you drop a pea size of masa. If it comes up and floats, you're ready to go. You're ready to start spreading.
Oh, you might even be tiny and just take a little ball.
Oh, yeah.
You're ready, baby. Yeah. Yeah.
Woo. We're ready.
Okay, so right now I'm teaching them how to spread the masa onto the husk. So what I told them is they get a dollop of the masa, the back of the spoon. So I started here, and I work my way down. You turn the hoja, spread sideways, spread down, down, down.
And after the spreading, there's the tamale stuffing.
Well, you have the traditional pork. And my favorite is cream cheese and jalapeno.
And the folding.
There, now it's perfect. It's in the fold.
Then the cooking.
Wait a couple hours, then you open it up, you take one out, and if when you take it out, it slips out, it's done. Now, it's not going to slip out completely because of the way we fold them.
Making tamales is an all-day affair, and Jesus says, yes, it's a lot of work, but it's worth it.
I think being connected to my parents, because this is such an important tradition to them that I want to share it with everybody else. It's also important for my daughter to see me participating in these things, and she participates as well. And it's really nice to have someone look at you and thank you for having reconnected them with something they thought was lost. It really makes you feel good about the work that you do, and that really is the reason we're doing it today.
And it just wouldn't be Christmas without homemade tamales. In San Antonio, David Martin Davies reporting.
Did you ever use one of these? A mortar and pestle kind of thing? My mom had one.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also comment directly on our website at TPR. And that's where you're going to find past Texas Matters programs. You can also find them on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.